and welcome to Introducing Me. I'm your host, Sarah. I started this podcast to get to know other people and lifestyles while discovering more about myself. Each episode, I'll give a new guest a chance to discuss their background, culture, interests, or whatever they want to talk about to help increase all of our own worldviews. Today, I would like to introduce you to Mimi. She's here to talk about her life. She was a first-generation student in college. She is a person of color. She was not born in the United States, but she is here now. And just kind of whatever she wants to share about her life, I'm really excited to have her here today. So, Mimi, why don't you say hello and introduce yourself?
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah. Hello, dear listeners. I'm so excited to be here. And as Sarah mentioned, wherever this conversation takes us, you know, I'm super excited to be here and just share a little bit about my life and my story and to chat.
Great. So why don't you take us from the beginning? We'll go chronologically. What it was like growing up, what it was like coming to America. I'm not quite sure when that happened in your life, so anything you can share there.
Yeah, for sure. So I was born in Bamako, which is the capital city of Mali. Mali's a country in West Africa. So we're kind of near Mauritania and Senegal, like that little, you know, hump of Africa. We're like in that side in Western Africa. And so I was born there. Spend most of my childhood there, and I moved to the U.S. when I was 10. So my parents actually lived in the U.S. for a pretty long time. They moved here when I was about 4. So I was actually raised by my great aunt, which in my culture technically counts as like my grandma, and she's also my namesake. So I was named after my father's aunt, and she was the one that raised me along with my great uncle, which is so weird for me to say great aunt and great uncle, because in our culture, like, your grandparents' siblings also count as grandparents. Like, you know, we're just like, you know, these are our grandparents too. So yeah, my parents moved here right before 9/11. So my dad came in 2000 and my mom came in 2001 in August. And I didn't move here permanently until 2007. So I came once for like a quick summer vacation, but I went back. I didn't move permanently till I was 10. So when I moved here, I still live in the Bronx, and, you know, my parents have been living in the Bronx ever since, here in New York. And I attended elementary school, so that was my first time going to school in America. So when I came, I was supposed to actually go to sixth grade, but because I didn't speak English, they put me back a grade. And they actually wanted to put me back 2 grades, and my mom was like, that is not happening. Like, you're not going to put her behind for so long. And it was such a weird dynamic. You know, I was, my school was just like around the corner from my house, very diverse. And I remember the first day I went with my mom for them to, you know, register me as a student. And I didn't speak English, right? So I spoke 3 languages at the time, but English was not one of those languages. So when I went, I remember my mom just like, going back and forth with the administration, trying to convince them that, you know, if they give me a chance, that I can actually do the work and catch up to other students. Like, you know, it's bad enough that I'm not going to my right grade. So for them to try to put me back to 4th grade when I'm supposed to be in the 6th grade was already a no-no. And I remember the assistant principal, who was a Haitian woman who spoke French, came up to me in the middle of like them going back and forth. She came up to me and she started speaking to me in French because she spoke French. And she was just, you know, asking me simple questions like my name, how I was feeling, what's different about America. So we were just having a simple conversation. And she was the only one that was also able to read my report card from Mali, because my report card was in French. So the school had no idea what kind of student I was or what was going on. They were just like, she doesn't speak English, put her back 3 years. So she was kind of like my guardian angel in a way. So she came, she was looking at my report card and asking me questions about, you know, some of my grades and my favorite subjects and things like that. And she was the one that went back to the principal and said, she's a very smart girl. We should really give her a chance. I think she can be, you know, a really strong student here. Now that I look back at this, I don't think this was really fair. So what they did was they decided to put me on a 2-week trial, right? 2 weeks. So they were like, okay, we're going to put you in a fifth grade class for 2 weeks and see how you do. So think about it. I'm a foreign student in a foreign land. I do not speak a lick of English. And they're like, yeah, in 2 weeks, let's see how much of this curriculum you can understand. And this is where math became my savior. And I hate math. Like, I've never been a fan of math, but I've always been good at it. So I remember in those class, in those 2 weeks, I would just sit in class clueless for, you know, 8+ hours a day, just sitting there watching people talk back and forth, back and forth. And I would, like, write down words that I kept hearing over and over again. So when I went home, I can ask my mom, like, what does this word mean? And I remember the very first word was because, or at least the way I heard it was because though, because people would always say because of, but to my untrained English ears or lack thereof, I was like, what is because though? Like, everyone keeps saying because though. So I went home and I asked my mom, I was like, what is this word? And she explained it to me. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And that would happen like every day for the rest of those 2 weeks. But the only time, like, I guess I was able to really participate in class was when we were doing math. And I quickly learned that I was pretty, like, ahead of the class in math. So when I was in Mali, I went to a private school there. And it was a pretty good school. And over there, like, the education system is very different from the U.S. So when I came here, they were learning, and this is, like, you know, first week of school in fifth grade, they were learning, like, I think fractions or going over, like, divisions and simple things that I had learned years ago in, like, third grade. So I was just, like, finishing my class. Like, I would see the, you know, the question, and I would finish it really fast, and the teacher would look at my work. And the way I solved the problem was very different from the way he was teaching it, but my answer was still correct. So one of the biggest differences that I noticed was that the way we did divisions in Mali was the way that it's done in France, which is very different. I don't even know how to explain it because I forgot that system. So he would look at my work, he's like, what is this? And then, but the answer will be correct. So long story short, I passed my 2 week trial because they saw that I was a really good math student, and my homeroom teacher was like a math fanatic, so he loved math, and that made him really excited. So they decided to keep me in the class after those 2 weeks. And actually, with like 2 weeks after those 2 weeks, another African student came to our school who ended up being my best friend. She came from Guinea. So Guinea is Somali and Guinea shares a border. So like they're literally like two connected countries. Her name was also Aminata, but her last name was different. So, you know, the school was just having a field day. They're like, what? Two African students named Aminata, you know, same age, same grade, same story. Like, this is insane. Let's put them in the same class. So they put her in my class as well, and we became really good friends. And together, we were just kind of like, we're going to show these American students that we're so much better. And it was such a funny thing to see because we didn't speak their language. But, you know, I ended up becoming fluent in English by November. So we started school in September, and by November, I was already fluent. So, and this is like my little tip to parents anywhere. Like, if you want your kids to learn languages, like, teach them young or just put them in an environment where, you know, they're just surrounded by that, because that's how I learned, right? So at home, I spoke my two native African languages with my family, which are Mandinka and Bambara. I also speak French. But in school, I was surrounded by English speakers all day long. So, you know, being in that environment for more than 8 hours every single day for 2 months, I was able to become super fluent in English. And by November, I became student of the month. And that did not sit well with a lot of the students in my class. They were just like, this girl just came from Africa. She knows nothing. And it was just, let's just say I was a subject of bullying a lot. But thankfully for me, for a good amount of my time there, I didn't understand what the bullies were saying. So it was a pretty interesting experience looking back. But yeah, so after then, you know, continued on all the way through high school. And then I went to Susquehanna, where Sarah also went.
Yes, I was going to ask you, like, so how long did it take you to learn English? Like, I'm sure that was difficult. And you're like, oh, a couple months. Like, so it's really cool to hear that full immersion, like, it worked. And I'm sure having another student with a similar background and similar language experience really helped in that situation.
Yeah, for sure. She and I, we communicated mostly in French. There was a third student that I should probably bring in. Well, who is also one of my best friends now. I literally saw her yesterday because she lives across the street. So her name was Catherine. Catherine was also an immigrant, but she was from Guatemala. So she also came that same year at our school, did not speak English, only spoke Spanish, and she was also put in our class just by virtue. I don't know why the school thought that was a good idea, just put all these immigrant kids in one class. and she spoke Spanish and we spoke French, but somehow we were able to communicate with each other. But I would say for me personally, like a lot of people always say English is a hard language. And that may be true, but that was not my experience. I think, you know, I find that French is a very hard language. Like Spanish is super difficult, even though it was like my second language. I recognize that it's still a very hard language. So being that I already spoke French, when I came here, English just seemed like a cakewalk. You know, we didn't have feminine or masculine pronouns for things. You know, the table was not whatever, you know, masculine or feminine. It's just the table, right? So I thought that was so fascinating. Like, and, you know, because of things like that, I was able to learn English much faster compared to all the other languages I spoke at the time. But having a friend definitely did help. We were able to also use each other as resources. And I remember another word that I did not know how to pronounce. I remember one day she corrected me and I was a little mad about it because I was mad that I didn't know the word already, was idea. So, and this happens to me even now as someone who's been living in America for more than 13 years now. When I see a word, like an English word that I've never heard someone pronounce out loud, my brain automatically pronounces that word in French. I never know how to pronounce, like I can't just look at a book and pronounce it the English or the American way because I've never heard it. And I do know American grammar could get a little tricky. Like you can have the same letters make different sounds depending on how it is. Like, for example, read and red are spelled the same way. Like it makes no sense. So so I remember, you know, I knew. So in French, the word like idea is idée. And I seen it, you know, written in books in English. And I knew that, you know, okay, this is idea. But I've never heard someone say it out loud. So when I was speaking and I said idea, right? So automatically just like went to that French pronunciation. I was like idea. And my friend is like, it's idea, it's not idea. I was like, what do you mean? The I makes the E sound. But then again, so we went back and forth and I realized I was pronouncing it in French and she was right and I was wrong. So there was a lot of that. And that continues to happen even now as an adult.
So are you still using your French or either of the African languages, or are you pretty much living fully in English now?
Oh, no, we do not speak English at home at all. So I only speak English like in times like this or when I'm working at home. So at home we speak a mixture of the two African languages and a little bit of French and just kind of like throw in, you know, into one. We do not speak English at home. My siblings, however, so I'm the oldest, right? And I have three younger siblings and they were all born here in the U.S. So their like life and their perception of like our culture and our family is completely different from mine because they haven't really spent a significant amount of time in Mali. They're, you know, they're Americans. My siblings will speak English sometimes, but they understand and speak our languages, if that makes sense. But we do not speak English at home. So yeah, it's to the point where like I find that because of COVID, because I've been home for so long, I've noticed that like people have told me that like my accent is a little more visible these days than it was like a few years ago because I've been home this whole time speaking mostly in my languages. And a lot of times like people would ask me like, where is your accent from? Because it's not easily detectable. Like when I speak, you can tell I'm a foreigner, but it's like, where is she from? And I'm just like, I don't even know where I'm from. Like my accents are a combination of all the languages I speak. And also growing up in the Bronx, I picked up Spanish. So I'm not super fluent in Spanish, but I would say I'm like intermediate, high intermediate. Like I can have a full blown conversation with you in Spanish, but, and also ended up taking Mandarin in high school, which I completely forgot because I don't have anyone to practice it. But I, you know, I really like languages and I'm fascinated with like the connection between languages and cultures, different cultures that I feel like now my English is suffering a little bit because you can hear like 100,000 languages in one sentence and you have no idea where it's from.
So what was the culture shift like from growing up in Africa to then being in the Bronx. And as you said, the Bronx was very multicultural, and then switching then to Susquehanna, which is very, very whitewashed.
Yeah. So believe it or not, I've had a bigger culture shock moving from New York to Susquehanna than I did moving from like Africa to America. Like, it's insane. So, and I'll explain why. So when I was in Mali, you know, I was born and raised in the capital city. You know, I grew up in a city environment. And even though like majority of Malians are Black, I would say 100% to be honest, like most Malians are Black. Mali's like a very diverse, like ethnically diverse country. So, you know, I grew up, you know, hearing so many different languages and dialects, and like you will go from one part of Mali to the other part and you'll meet people who like the skin color will range from like me to you. Like there are people who are like as white as white people and people who are just like as dark as me. So Mali is a very, very diverse country. And that's something that I love so much about my country. And with that comes diverse people and diverse, you know, food, languages, etc. So I came from a cosmopolitan place. And also my family in Mali was pretty educated for the most part. So like my maternal grandma was a professor. And on my dad's side, there were politicians, which kind of explains my interest in politics. So like my paternal grandpa was a senator and a diplomat. And he was someone I grew up seeing on TV a lot because he was very involved in politics and still was, you know, so were like his friends and brothers and siblings. So like I grew up seeing a lot of my family members on TV because of their political connections or just where they worked. So I came from, I guess, a pretty, like, I wouldn't say affluent, but I guess educated, or you could say in comparison to here, like, yeah, pretty affluent family in Mali. And I kind of was used to a certain way of, like, a certain lifestyle. And that's also part of the reason why when I came here, I was able to just pick up the curriculum really fast in school. Like, I was actually ahead of the students here, which is pretty interesting. So I went from a private school in Mali to a public school in America. And but in terms of culture shock, there were some, but not significant enough for me to be like, oh my gosh, what is this, right? So when I came here, you know, I was still in a predominantly African community, and I'm Muslim, and we have like 5 mosques within like walking distance from like where I live. It was just like, it was something new, you know, because, you know, now I'm surrounded by, like, I see white people, I see Asians, I see Hispanics and Latinx people. But, you know, I still see my connections to my African roots, et cetera. And also being in New York City, you see people from all over the world. So it was not that big of a culture shock moving from Africa to America. But growing, what I would consider like your critical years in America, right? So I came here when I was 10. So from 10, you know, I came here as a kid, and I spent all of my preteen and teenage years in New York, and then went to Susquehanna at the age of 18. That was a culture shock, you know, growing up in New York, getting used to a certain way of life, you know, having a corner store, having access to things whenever you want, 24 hours, public transportation. Like, it was just a different world. And I got so used to that, that when I went to SU, I'm just like, there's no stores. Like, I have to go to Walmart. Like, it was just, everything was so different. And on top of that, as you mentioned, I went from a very diverse city to a very, very, you know, not so diversity in feelings growth. And not only that, like, you know, the racial and ethnic diversity that I was missing in SU also came with political and socioeconomic diversity as well, right? So being a student at SU, now I'm surrounded by like some 1%ers and like a bunch of Republicans. And, you know, that's something you never really think about when you live in a city like New York. Like, you know, you're living in a life where like there is racism and microaggressions, but it's not as common or as commonly accepted, I guess you would say. Like, if someone does something racist on a train, the entire train is going to defend you, right? Whereas when I went to Susquehanna, and this is not particularly, you know, for SU only, but like in that Sealands Grove area, it was just a different way of life. You know, most people were not working in Wall Street or having these big fancy jobs. And it's like a smaller community, and everyone is like, you know, it was a more communal feel. It was just, it was very different. And a lot of the students that were in my class were also from Central PA or areas similar to Susquehanna. So college was not a big shift for them. But for me, not only was I an immigrant in America, you know, discovering a new part of America, I was also technically a first-generation college student because my parents did not attend school in America. Like, my parents went to school in Mali. So their I guess, educational journey or experiences were a little irrelevant to mine, right? So, like, they couldn't understand. Even I remember even applying to college, like, doing things like FAFSA. My mom did not know what FAFSA was. My dad did. Like, they're just like, what is this? I'm just like, I don't know. I need your tax papers, I think. And so, you know, like, I had to kind of navigate my entire college journey itself by myself with the help of some high school guidance counselors. But for the most part, my parents weren't really, like, they were very supportive of everything I did, which I love. You know, they've been there for me the entire way, but they really couldn't give me an advice the same way someone whose parents might have went to school in America could. So for me, not only was I, you know, facing all of these different things, and also for once in my life actually being reminded that, like, oh, you are a Black person, and what does that mean? Right, so 2015 was a pretty hot year, and 2015 was a year I was a freshman. It was a pretty hot year in terms of, like, racial discrimination and, you know, violence and just all the things that were happening that we see happening now, or we saw happening especially this summer, were happening in 2015 and even before that, right? So for me, it's like, you know, being a young adult plucked out of, like, your community and plugged into a different place where you are an extreme minority, like, you're an immigrant, you're a woman, you're Black, you're Muslim, like, you're everything that, like, no one else in this town is. It was pretty hard trying to, like, do all of that and at the same time balance three majors. So for me, I would say I had great, you know, mentors at SU and great advisors, and also made some pretty cool friends who were able to help me through my process. And I was lucky enough to have met friends at SU that were ironically all from New York. Like, my college best friends all live in New York, and we're all still friends to this day, which is so funny because, as you know, there weren't that many, like, people of color at SU to begin with. So the fact that I was able to make so many great friends from different backgrounds and they were all from the same city was the icing on the cake. But I feel like I could write a whole book about my experience, you know, moving from New York to Susquehanna. Like, it would be a whole book.
So how did you find Susquehanna, and how did you end up graduating with three majors?
Yes, the trigger, three majors. So it's funny, right? When I look back on my high school, when I was, like, that time in high school where I was looking at colleges, I now notice that I was looking at colleges that were very similar to Susquehanna. And I didn't, at the time, again, you know, when you're living in a city like New York, you don't think that there are, or even for me, so I grew up in a diverse city. I moved to a diverse city. I never thought about the fact that, like, there would be a world where diversity did not exist. Like, it was just kind of like, imagine a fish living in water. Like, you would never think, like, anyone would ever put you somewhere where there's no water. So that's kind of like what it was for me. When I was looking at schools, I was looking at schools with a very blank eye. You know, I was searching for schools that had certain programs I wanted, certain curriculums, and, you know, so, like, I wanted to study abroad, I wanted to, you know, I knew that I couldn't decide on three, like, on my major, so I was just like, I want a school that's going to have a focus in international studies, that's, like, diplomacy, because I kind of want to be a diplomat / ambassador one day. I was searching for schools that had, like, international studies programs with different choices for me, so I was, like, strictly looking at all of these schools through an academic lens, and I never considered the social aspect of it at all, or even, like, racial makeup or whatever. Like, I did not know what a predominantly white institution was, nor was it something that was even part of my vocabulary, because I didn't really care for it, because I thought, you know, it would be just like New York. So I was, you know, my high school was a pretty good high school. They started preparing us for college since our freshman year. Like, all of our class trips were, like, to colleges. So college was, like, something that, like, it was, like, embedded into my high school curriculum. And we would have conversations with college advisors all the time, and like, you know, different schools would come and present, and we would go visit different schools. So for me, like for my freshman year to my senior year, I would just take note of like the schools that I liked or the type of schools that I liked. So I slowly figured out that I wanted to be at a smaller school because I've been in small schools my whole life. So I knew I wanted to be at a small school where like my professors knew me. So I broke it down to all of these categories, and it just so happened that everything I wanted from a college experience were things that I saw at liberal arts colleges. So I didn't care for the Harvards or the Princetons or like the big name schools. Even after I could have gotten into them, I was just something I didn't care about. I wanted to go to a school where I felt like I would actually enjoy myself and have a relationship with my professors and get to know my classmates. So to bring it back to your question a little bit, Susquehanna was actually not my first choice. I was set on going to Gettysburg, which you can imagine. So I had a cousin at Gettysburg who, she was actually not having fun at Gettysburg at all, but it's just looking at that curriculum, I was like, this school would be amazing for me for X, Y, and Z reasons. And my cousin would also be there. And it was like the December. So think of like, you know, the college applications cycle, right? So in December, and Isaac Moore, I don't know if you remember Isaac Moore, he used to work at admissions, comes to my high school. He was the admissions rep for New York City. So Isaac Moore comes to my high school, gives this incredible presentation about this little school called Susquehanna that I've never heard of in my life. And I almost didn't even go to the presentation. I told my my high guidance counselor, I'm just like, I already know what's going on. I'm going to Gettysburg. I'm not going to go watch another presentation. Like, this is a waste of my time. And my guidance counselor convinced me to just go listen. She was like, just go. You never know. You might like it. So I went. She was right. I ended up liking it. And I exchanged contacts with Isaac. We went back and forth. And, like, he told me to apply. And I applied that same day. I got an answer back the next week. And from there, as we just got closer and closer to like that May 1st deadline, Susquehanna just became a clear, obvious winner. So I ended up actually not going to Gettysburg, spoiler alert, and went to SU instead. But yeah, even like schools like Bucknell, I know you mentioned Bucknell. So I applied to Bucknell, I applied to Fairfield, like Dickinson, so many Susquehanna-ish kind of schools because they all had something in common that was, you know, the liberal arts aspect of it. So that's how I ended up at SU, you know. Shout out to the admissions office. I worked for them for a really long time when I was a student. But yeah, so that's how I found out about Susquehanna. And so I visited during an open house with my dad. We drove up for one of the open houses that were happening. And I ended up loving the campus. Everyone was so nice, which I thought was a little suspicious. Like, I remember saying to my dad, like, why are they all smiling at me? Like, this is not, like, what is this? And, you know, as a New Yorker, you're not used to people just randomly saying hi to you or smiling at you. So for me, I was a little creeped out by the fact that everyone was being so nice. And then I realized, like, oh, they're not faking. Like, this is really what they do here. Okay. So that's how I found SU and ended up accepting my my admissions there and spent 4 years.
So when you came for that visit, and you're right, everyone at Susquehanna is really nice and tries to be super welcoming. So it's not just a show. You know, most people at Susquehanna are happy. When you were there doing that visit, did you notice that it was a predominantly white school? Like, when did it click for you that it wasn't going to be like New York?
Yeah, it was definitely. So, yeah, I think that was the first time I actually realized it was a very white school. But that also, I feel like so many other great things happened that day that I was able to not focus on that. So when I was there, you know, like we had a full curriculum, I was meeting with, oh, another reason why I went to SU, this is one of my favorite stories, was because of Dr. Keskin. Many people at Susquehanna right now probably don't know who Dr. Keskin is because he left after my freshman year. But Dr. Keskin was the chair of the International Studies Department. And so once Isaac kind of got like a hold of me, so did Dr. Keskin. I don't know what kind of like file exchange system the admissions office had with academic departments. But so as soon as I kind of like spoke to Isaac and, you know, told him I was interested in IS, like the next day, Dr. Keskin called my house, right? And I come home and my mom is like, yeah, a professor from a university called for you? I was like, bud, that's so weird. And I was like, just ignore it. And then he kept calling and calling and calling. And even after I got admitted, right? So I finally, like, I would answer his calls sometimes. And I was like, hi, yes. And I would tell him, like, I'm going to Gettysburg. Like, I'm not going to Susquehanna. And he's like, yes, I understand that. But let me tell you a little bit about our program and tell you a little bit about X, Y, and Z. Like, he went so hard. He wanted me to go to Susquehanna so badly. And I got to meet him at the open house. And I was just like, hi, I'm Aminata. You know, we've spoken on the phone a few times, and he got so excited. And then, so later on as a student, he became my advisor, right? And I asked him about it. I was like, why? I was like, did you do this for our entire cohort? Because our cohort of IS students for that year, I think there was 9 of us, 9 to 12, like no more than 12. So we were a very small cohort. And the first week of school, freshman year, he took us out to the Kyan Cafe. And I brought up this story and as a joke, and everyone else at the table was like, wait, he did that to me too. And we're all like, wait a second. Did you do this for everyone? So, you know, like that, my first day on campus visiting as, you know, a prospective student was filled with like experiences like that, where I was meeting like really great professors and even some like potential friends, like other high school students who are visiting who would be my classmates, that I kind of like nothing happened that made me go, oh yeah, this is a racist school or this is a bad school for me, you know? So I was able to, like, I would say distracted. And I would say I didn't really do my homework about how different Sealands Grove is, or just things to expect. So all of those lessons came, you know, my freshman year, and I was able to navigate through them. But I would say when I look back at my Susquehanna experience, like the one thing the one word I would say is like support. Like I had a really, really great support team, plus from like professors to friends to even just people who were like staff members, like, and I mentioned Leslie, because, you know, you work with her, like, Leslie was such a great support system for me there, and so many other people who just took interest in me and made sure that I felt welcome, so I'm always grateful for that. So, yeah, I felt like I was a little duped, or a little, you know, like, there was a little bit of a hidden figure there.
Well, I'm glad to hear that it definitely all worked out well. And Susquehanna does pride itself on those support networks. And I know there's a lot of things in place that they continue to make things better and have it be more inclusive. And I, you know, negatively called it whitewashing. But that's also just...
I mean, it is that, too. It is whitewashing. I definitely agree with you.
And since I now work there and am in the area, I very much am around all of the lack of diversity because I don't live in the college town either. So even just a little bit farther out, it's definitely noticeable. Now, we were talking a little bit beforehand about you being the SGA president and that you were the first Student Government Association president that was a person of color. So can you explain what that experience was like?
Yeah, so... I'm not sure if I was the first person of color. Like, I don't know if there were, like, a Hispanic or, like, someone of, like, Arab descent or something. But I know for a fact that I was the first Black president of SGA. And it was an interesting experience. So I joined the Student Government Association my freshman year. I became the president of the freshman class in 2015. So I'm class of 2019. So when I joined SGA, there were only 3 Black people in SGA, you know, so it was just 3 of us out of the 40-something members who were part of this organization. And I remember since that day always saying to myself, like, this is kind of, you know, not fair. And I kind of went on a quest to figure out why is there no, like, I guess, better representation. So I started speaking to some other, I spoke to people who've been in SGA, you know, before me to kind of get like a sense of like what things had happened. Like, I'm like, oh, you know, have there been elections where students of color have participated and they just lost? Like, what was the issue? And I ended up finding out that it was kind of twofold. Like, yes, there was some sort of systemic issue where there was just not enough, I guess, opportunity for students of color to join, but also a lot of students of color were just not interested in joining this super duper white body of students, right? Not only white, but also very male dominated. There's been research that shows that, I think this is something that Colleen actually did for her PhD, Colleen from Meslife. When I first met her, she said to me that her dissertation was about student government and how, like, male-washed it is. You know, most student government leaders are men. And so when she came, she was very proud to see that, like, our student SGA was predominantly women, like a lot of badass women in our SGA. And so for me, you know, I was told that I think I was the sixth woman to be in the position as well. So, you know, it was a lot going on, but I would say I made it a goal of mine to try to get as much diversity in there as possible in those 4 years. And also, I knew I wanted to be SGA president since my freshman year. So I was kind of like, in a weird way, setting myself up, you know, like, you know, setting up the body I wanted before I was elected. So, I remember, you know, that same year, my freshman year, we were rewriting the SGA Constitution, and I was part of the committee that rewrote that Constitution. And even after that was written, we kept changing and changing and changing it because of the new Constitution. So we were, as the school was changing, we're also trying to find a way to fit out, like to design our body in a way that is sustainable. And so we brought in new positions and took out old positions and played around with so many different things. And I realized that, so when I became president, I realized that majority of the liaison positions were appointed by the president, right? So, and I told myself, I'm like, okay, if the president appoints these positions, then it is my duty to seek out qualified, you know, candidates who would be a good in this position, but also bring some diversity to this. So one thing I did that was different was instead of just like, so most presidents in the past just like appointed people that they knew who would be good fits, which chances are would be other white students, or just people that were already in SGA, like, you know, so it was a weird system, like that was not super defined, and each president kind of did their own thing. So something that I did was that I decided to open up the liaison application to everyone. So I created an application instead of just like appointing my friends. I created an application because I knew that there were more students on campus that I didn't know who would be qualified, that, you know, just wanted to give other people a chance to get into this very exclusive body. So that's one thing we wanted to just shatter. Like, we wanted to shatter the stereotype that SGA was an exclusive body. So we opened up this application, and I laid out the description for each liaison position and said, hey, if you're interested in this, send me an email, like, you know, X, Y, and Z, like, telling me why. And it was, in a weird way, it was a blind admissions process, right? So I was able to just read those applications and again, I didn't know most of these people at all. So just from reading their applications, I was able to say to myself, like, oh, wow, like this person would be a perfect fit for like a residence life liaison or, you know, a sustainability liaison. And at the end of the, again, I have never seen these people, never met them, did not even know what they looked like. And I remember our first meeting when they were all being sworn in, I felt so proud to see such a diverse room, you know. So not only were we able to have racial diversity, we were also able to have ethnic diversity. And even, you know, we had students who were trans, students who were bi, lesbian, gay, like so many different, like it was the entire rainbow in every way, shape, or form. And I felt so proud because I had never seen that in my last 4 years in SGA. So by literally just opening up this application to anybody on campus. And again, Susquehanna is a predominantly white campus. So if we're looking at numbers and proportions, we should have technically got a lot of white students that made the cut. But just by looking at this process that was blinded, we were able to give opportunities to people who were a little shyer or people that we've never met before. And some of these individuals ended up becoming some of the best reps we had. And a lot of them are still in student government to this day, even though I'm gone. So that's something I'm very proud of, and I hope that, you know, the student government continues to diversify, because I've noticed that when we have a diverse group of body, you know, not only diverse in the way we look, but also diverse in the way that we think, you know, we were able to get so much done and able to cover so many grounds and reach so many other groups of students on campus, right? So we weren't just tapping into our friend groups. We were also tapping into other groups of people on campus who were never really represented in our body. And it led to more advocacy and more representation and more change. So if that's a long answer for your question.
But you should definitely be proud of that work. And it sounds like it worked out so well. And, you know, hopefully they are still you know, taking those ideals and making sure that it is more fair and less about who you just know, because that's when you only go to things of who you just know, you get a lot of people like yourself.
Exactly.
So would you be able to talk a little bit, you mentioned when your parents first came over that it was right before 9/11 and that you are Muslim. So would you be able to share that experience and what that is like and what your faith means to you?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting. So it's funny, so my class, or like people who are my age, were considered the kindergarten class of 9/11. So like we were technically in kindergarten when 9/11 happened. And I remember when the 10-year anniversary happened a few years ago, it was like this big thing everyone was talking about. Well, not a few years, it was like 2011. So I remember in 2011, like it was like this thing. Everyone's like, oh my God, what happened to the kindergarten class of 9/11? Where are they now? Like these were, because also people kept thinking back to like George Bush. He was reading to a class of, I think, first graders or something. For some reason, everyone was fascinated by our group of, like our cohort. And I remember when I was graduating high school, it was like an article, I think in the New York Times or something. And it was like, oh, the kindergarten class of 9/11 is going to college, just to show people like how long ago this was, but also not how long ago it was. So for me, every September, everyone kind of has like their own 9/11 story. And it's like the one thing everyone asks, like, where were you on 9/11? And all of my friends, they all remember, because, again, we're technically the last cohort to really remember that day. And for me, I was just like, I don't know. It's like, I was not in America, right? So I don't really have – so my 9/11 story is very strange because I don't have one, right? So I was in Mali, and I'm sure, you know, it was international news, but because I wasn't living in a country that was – directly affected by 9/11, it wasn't something that, like, you know, kids in my country were really worried about. So I actually did not know what 9/11 was until I came to America, and I learned about it like every year. Like with each new 9/11 anniversary, I would learn a little more about the incident and what happened, and also from hearing stories of like other Muslim Americans in America. So my even though I'm a Muslim, my experience like with 9/11 has been sort of one of an outsider. Like I found connections to people through it, but I really wasn't there. So for my parents, you know, again, this is kind of where intersectionality comes into play. After 9/11, the Muslim community faced a lot of hatred and a lot of discrimination and violence, right? But because of ignorance, a lot of the targeted violence were also towards non-Muslims. Like the Sikh community, the Hindu community received a lot of hate because most people just assumed that all Muslims were Arab or of Arab descent or were just brown, But my family, you know, we're Black. And actually in America, I don't know if this is still true, but a big chunk of the American Muslim population are Black people. And even in my own country, Mali is a predominantly Muslim country, you know, I think it's like 98 or 95% Muslim. So I've always, you know, for me, it's like I've always been around Black Muslims that like when I look at Islam, I don't just automatically think of Arab people. But I've noticed that since 9/11, that's kind of been a perception that like, oh, these Arabs are bad. And it's a very loaded thing, and like that comes with so many different intersectional parts. But long story short, there was a lot of like lack of education there. And but for me, I learned all of that just from talking to people when I came here, trying to understand that like, what does this mean? All right, and it kind of connects to the topic of even my Blackness, right? Being Black was not significant in my life until I really wanted to go to Canada. Or let me not say that. It wasn't until like high school. Like, you know, the killing of Trayvon Martin was like the first time I was ever like, oh my God, like racism is real, right? So before that, I've never really experienced racism, at least not outwardly. But, you know, it was one of those things where I'm just like, okay, I'm a Black person in this world where people are still, you know, hateful. And when I went to college, it became even deeper because I realized that most people perceived me to be African-American, right? So it was just like they would see me there, just like they would identify me as African American, Black American, or just assume that like my heritage or my culture went back to like slavery or the South or just the typical stereotype. Like they just assume I was just a Black American person. And that was something that I had to talk to a lot of my friends about. I was just like, hey, like, this is not my story, you know, even like Black History Month and things like that, like people would ask me to share certain stories and I was just like, I can't tell you about my family's transplantation. I've never, like, that's not my story, you know. Black people are not a monolith. We're not, like, we're all very diverse. And I think that also, for me being a African American, I was able to share that story with a lot of people and show that not all Black people come from the same place. Like, so I was like, I'm actually African, period. Like, I'm not American at all. Like, I still have a green card. Like, I'm a real immigrant. And so for that, I kind of had a bit of an identity crisis. And I feel like I'm still figuring it out a little bit where, you know, where I'm like, forced to learn about the lies and the struggles and the systemic racism set against Black Americans, because at the end of the day, race is all about perception, and people are going to see me and they're not going to say, oh, she's not, you know, Black American, she's African, she's special. That's not going to happen. You know, they're going to treat me the same way they would treat other Black people. And same with Islam, is that, so my family is Black and most people don't associate Black people with Islam. I've never heard any like crazy stories from my mom or dad about the way they were treated, especially since like we don't, like my mom doesn't wear the veil, like the hijab, neither do I. So I was like, that was another thing. It's like, how are you Muslim? You don't wear the hijab. It's like, again, I could write a whole book about these topics. But so yeah, for me, like the 9/11 topic doesn't, like my family thankfully was not too affected by it. However, the Muslim, my faith community was very much affected by it and continues to be affected by it. And I think, you know, by having conversations with people and talking and sharing our stories, we can definitely become a better society. You know, I've learned that in America, the two things people never talk about at the dinner table is like, we don't talk about politics and we don't talk about religion. And I'm like, well, and you wonder why we have so many problems with politics and religion in this country. It's like, no one wants to talk about it. So, you know, I think it's time for all of us to really actually make an effort to embrace our differences and be able to come together. Even if we disagree, I'll find a way to talk to each other, because I think stories can really change people's lives and also give you a better perspective. And I've seen it happen with so many people at SU just from meeting me and like hearing about my life and how completely different I was from them. It changed a lot of the way that they looked at certain situations, you know? Oh, yeah.
Well, I appreciate you sharing all of that. Now, before we wrap up, is there anything else that you would like to share with the listeners about you and your story?
Oh, this is hard. this is hard. Anything I would like to share? Because I feel like I have a lot to share.
There's only so much time we have.
Okay. I guess I could do like a book recommendation that I just recently read. So, sure. Yeah, at the beginning of COVID, I started a book club, like a digital book club with my friends, because we were all bored out of our minds. And so we started this book club, and it's 10 of us. And each month we pick a book. Right now we're actually reading the Asada Shakur autobiography. So one book that we read this summer, it was called Homegoing by Ya Gyasi. So Ya is Y-A-A, and her last name is G-Y-A-S-I, and the title of the book is Homegoing. So the book came out in 2016, I believe, and she was only, like, 26 when the book was published, and it's, like, now, like, a New York Times bestseller, and it's just, she is an incredible writer. But anyway, the reason why I love this book so much was, so the book is so fascinating, without giving away, like, you know, some of the plot, is basically the book follows the descendants of this one woman from Ghana for eight generations, right? So this woman, she has two daughters. One daughter gets sold to slavery. Like, so again, this book, it starts in Ghana, right? So one daughter is sold into slavery and, like, you know, is brought to America, and all of her kids and her grandkids and, you know, her lineage continues in America. And the other daughter gets married to, like, one of the colonizers in Ghana. So she, like, married this, like, rich white guy in Ghana, and her lineage continues in Ghana. And so for eight generations, each chapter goes back and forth. So, like, you'll meet, like, someone from the American side and someone from the Ghanaian side, and it goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And the book is also historically pretty accurate. Like, you know, it starts, like, you know, in the pre-colonial days, and it ends in, like, the early 2000s. So you kind of get to see. So for me, it was such a eye-opening book, because as someone who's living between two worlds where, you know, I am very African, but also because I spent so much time here, I'm also very American. It's kind of like, and also, as I mentioned, most people assume that I'm just Black American and that I have a certain life story. I'm just like, I might as well learn what these, you know, certain life stories are so that I'm prepared to answer these questions the right way. It was so fascinating seeing a book that shares, like, you know, it's a fictional book, by the way, like this, it didn't really happen in real life, but seeing a book that covers the life of, like, it shares the trauma of slavery and colonization from both angles. And for me, I was able to learn so much, not only about the American side of the story, but also the African side, right? And I realized that I didn't really know much about what was happening in Ghana at the time, historically, and even some of the things that were happening in this one family. And it was such a great book, and I highly recommend it for anyone who's trying to learn a little bit more about some of the intricacy and complexities of race in America, and how it's not just an American thing, and it has a different face, you know, in a different format in every country you go to, even in Africa. So, yeah, I got home going.
Yeah, and I'll definitely leave the information in the description of this podcast so that people can find it. And for me personally, it sounds like a fascinating book. I really like fiction books, so I find when I'm trying to find nonfiction informational books that would help me learn more about other cultures and things, I feel like I'm reading a required textbook. So I like that this is mostly historically accurate, but also an actual story.
Yeah, I'm also really into nonfiction. I'm not really into novels, but this one was a really good catch.
So with all of my guests, I like to end it out with a fun, random question. Typically, it doesn't have to do with anything that we've talked about. So my question for you is kind of specific because I knew of you from Susquehanna. And my question is, where do you get your sense of fashion?
That is so funny. I would say my mom, for sure. So this is a really funny recent story. So my birthday was last Monday, and my friends surprised me with a very COVID-ish birthday, like last year of a party. I don't even know what to call it. A few of my friends basically came to my house, dropped off a bunch of like desserts and gifts and stuff like that, and hung out for a bit and then left, and the others were on Zoom. And while we're hanging out, so again, my mom is just in the house wearing like you would think she's going to the Mad Gala. Like, this is just a regular day for her, and like, she's wearing heels. And one of my cousins, she's the one that actually went to Gettysburg, she was just cracking up, and she took a picture of my mom and sent it to our group chat, and she was like, Mimi is her mother's daughter. Why is this lady wearing heels in the house on a Monday night? So my mom has always been someone who's like really into fashion and enjoys dressing up, and I feel like that just rubbed off on me as I was growing up. So yeah, I get my sense of fashion from my mom.
But that's so great. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sarah. This has been super fun.
Yeah, thank you. All right, so that brings this episode to a close. As I mentioned, I will leave the book that Mimi recommended in the description. And if you would like to connect with the podcast, we are on social media. We are on Instagram, Facebook, and I'm going to make it a personal goal to, by the time this episode launches, which is in a couple weeks from recording, so I have time, to also be promoting the podcast on LinkedIn. So that's how Mimi and I were able to connect to get this recording to happen. So I'm going to make it a goal to do that as well. If you would like to guest on the podcast, you can always send me an email. It is introducingmepodcast@gmail.com, and that is in the description. So I'm always looking to hear from new people, to share new stories. And if you would like to support the podcast, we are on Patreon, and those can be monthly donations or one-time donations, and every little bit helps. So thank you, Mimi, so much for spending time with me today. I really appreciated hearing everything you had to share, and to my listeners for taking the time out of your day to hear a new story. Until next week. Bye.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Bye, Sarah.